Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, with live streaming on dublincityfm.ie. Inside Education is your weekly mix of news, interviews, stories and features from the world of education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'm glad you can join me. If you want to suggest a topic for the programme or to comment on an issue, you can email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation, all one word, at dublincityfm.ie. You can text the programme at 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665. You can listen to previous Inside Education programmes on our website. That is www.insideed.com. That's www.insideed.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at InsideEd. Later in this week's programme, I'll bring you the second part of an interview with Professor Peter Afterback, who was a keynote speaker at the recent Reading Association of Ireland annual conference. Peter Afterback will speak about difficulties children have learning to read, professional development for teachers in reading, assessing reading competence, and about how parents can help their children with reading. But as always, we begin by taking a look back at the news stories about education from the last week. To do this, I am joined by Barry Hennessy. Welcome to the programme, Barry.
Hello again, Sean.
Barry, you have an update on an issue we discussed previously regarding Protestant secondary schools and cutbacks.
Well, yes, indeed, Sean. Several hundred Protestants representing clergy, school management and parents held an unprecedented meeting in Tallaght yesterday to discuss their response to education cutbacks, which have seen Protestant sector secondary schools facing arguably the biggest adjustments in the education sector this year. Under last October's budget, fee-paying Protestant schools were reclassified under the same category as fee-paying Catholic schools. The result was the withdrawal of a range of support grants and an increase of 2 in their pupil-teacher ratio from this September. Eleanor Petrie, spokesperson for the Protestant Parents Association Compass, was one of the speakers at yesterday's meeting.
We were very pleased to find that we had hundreds of parents, teachers and church leaders who came hundreds of people present to listen to our church leaders and to both parents and educators talk about the discriminatory cuts that have taken place in the last budget. I think the resolution that came from the conference probably sums up the feeling of the meeting in that we said we were extremely concerned and dismayed at the discriminatory treatment by the Minister of Education and the government of Protestant secondary schools. And we asked for the Minister to reinstate the right of Protestant parents to choose for their children a school which accords with their own ethos.
What form will protests or campaigning within your sector take from this point forward, do you think?
Well, we'll continue to meet with the politicians. We've continued to look for meetings with more of the cabinet. We've been very well facilitated by opposition who have met with us and have heard what we have to say. So that will be an ongoing part of our campaign. But I think the commitment of the hundreds of people in the hall yesterday was that they would all take this campaign back to their home ground, that they will be talking to their local politicians, they will be writing to their TDs, they will be writing to this government, and they will be contacting media. But more than that, I think what we are talking about here is raising the profile of this issue with every single part of Irish society. This is something that impacts on the entire society. How we treat our minorities really shows what kind of society we have. And if we are being discriminated in this way, against in this way, I think the whole of society needs to know that and needs to hold this government accountable.
And that was Eleanor Petrie from Compass, and we will continue to keep an eye on that issue. Barry, you've got good news about a long-established provider of services to people with intellectual disabilities being recognised for their work.
Staff at the Walkinstown Association in West Dublin were this week celebrating becoming the first whole-service provider for people with intellectual disabilities to achieve the National Human Resource Standard Excellence Through People Award. The award comes just months after the association was awarded for its human rights rights-based approach by the US-based Council on Quality and Leadership. Gail Gilbert, Policy Coordinator at the Walkinstown Association, has been telling us about what getting their Excellence in People Award entailed.
From our point of view, we did a staff survey, and from that, one of the areas that came out of that was that staff wanted a specialised performance development system so that they could link their own personal goals and what they aim to achieve in their work life with the actual organisation's overall strategic plan. So basically the plan can cascade down and be broken down into the strategic plan, down to team goals and then identified individual goals. And then through that the person could identify training that would be sufficient for them so that they could be in a better position to support the people that use their services.
What benefits, I suppose, or enhancements to the services you provide do you think achieving excellence through people will enable you to deliver?
Well, there's a number of achievements in terms of efficiency of service that we can provide for people. But I suppose one of the main areas when we look at a human resource standard like ETP is retention and recruitment. And I think particularly for the people who we support, it's very important for them that we've got an excellent record with staff retention. And this is certainly a tool that will help us do that, because by providing and supporting our staff and as best as they can, they're going to be encouraged to stay working with us for as long as possible. And I think that's possibly one of the strongest points that we can get from excellence through people.
And that was Gail Gilbert from the Walkinstown Association. Now, if you're a parent or teacher in the South Dublin County Council area, the month of October is as good a time as any to bring the kids along to your local library. Books to the Sky, a themed books festival for children, kicks off tomorrow at Clondalkin Library, and all public libraries in the area will be organising special children's events over the next 3 weeks. Here's Development Librarian Caroline Higgins.
Books to the Sky is South Dublin Library's Children's Book Festival. It starts on Monday and it celebrates the world of children's literature, from fantasy and fable to history and humour and everything in between. We have a fantastic programme of events for all ages. The festivities kick off on Monday with the launch at Clondalkin Library, and we have a storyteller from Australia who's on tour here in Ireland, and he is going to entertain the local school children that come along to the launch. The festival runs until Friday the 23rd of October. We've a great range of events for all ages. We've the cream of Irish writers with Oisín McGann, Aubrey Flegg, Mary Arrigan, Conor Costick, and that's just naming a few. And we also have some new and emerging authors. All the events are by booking, so if you telephone your local library and check out whether the event that you're interested in is available and book your class in, and then it's just a matter of coming down. It's all free. And for further information, they can check our website, www.southdublinlibraries.ie.
And that was Caroline Higgins, Development Librarian of South Dublin County Council, bringing this week's news to a close. Thanks to Barry Hennessy for bringing us up to date with those stories. You're tuned to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Inside Education, programme number 13 with Sean Delaney. To get in touch with the programme, you can text 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665 for your comments and suggestions. Last week I brought you an interview with Peter Afflerback about how children learn to read. You can still hear that interview on the website, which is www.insideed.com. This week I bring you the second part of that interview. Peter Afflerback from the University of Maryland in the United States was here as a guest of the Reading Association of Ireland, which held its annual conference last week. Last week on the programme, he spoke about how the teaching of reading changes as students grow older, how teachers can support wide disparities in pupils' reading in their class, the limitations of relying on phonics as a decoding strategy, and why international differences exist in learning to read. In this week's part of the interview, he speaks about barriers to becoming a good reader, how teachers can improve their teaching of reading, how reading competence can be assessed, and what parents can do to help their child read. I began this week's part of the interview by asking Peter Afflerback why some children have difficulties in learning to read.
There are a number of reasons why someone might have trouble learning to read. And, you know, I would say that the number of students who actually have an organic problem, something that represents hearing, speech, vision, some sort of wiring in the brain that just is not allowing reading development to happen, is actually a quite small number. In the clinics that I've worked in and the classrooms that I've been teacher in, what I see most often happening when there's difficulty is there's a mismatch between one of three things, and it's the student and where the student is developmentally. Then it's the nature of the text that the student is asked to read, and then the nature of the instruction. So if the instruction's not meeting the student exactly where the student is, then there will be misses. There'll be instructional misses. There won't be a connection of what the student can do to what they can do next. And then there's the text difficulty issue, which is some texts are just going to be too hard for students. If the vocabulary, information load, length of average length of sentence is too grand, then it will overwhelm the students. It will overwhelm their memory system. It will overwhelm their will to persevere. And so when you look at a classroom of struggling readers, you're looking at students who have often have cognitive challenges, but as important would be the affective challenges. They've learned that they're not so good at reading, and that becomes a growing knot in the process of trying to develop as a reader. It's as your self-image deteriorates, as your self-concept gets low, thinking about reading, it's human nature to back away from that, and that's part of the challenge of teaching a struggling reader.
So if you take those different causes of reading difficulty, say presumably if the text is too difficult, that's fairly easy to correct by finding alternative text. And what about, say, if there's an instructional problem, that's a matter of changing the instruction.
Right.
And the probably the most difficult one is if a child has some cognitive difficulties. What can be done in those cases to help those children learn to read?
Well, I'd say the most important thing, if you're dealing with a child with an organic deficit, is an accurate, detailed diagnosis, because you want to put your best effort in as a teacher, a diagnostician also, and you want the effort to be directed by the most fine-grained detail that you can have about exactly what is causing the problem with the child. In my experience, though, it's not always just a it's not a single etiology. It's not a single cause. It's about, you think about a third grader or a fourth grader who's had a career of failing in reading. And whatever you determine a cognitive need to be, you better address the affective need. You better address the probability that there's low motivation or no motivation to read. That you have to address the probability that the student will have very low self-esteem. And as I said earlier, there are very few human beings who like to participate in activities in which they know they're going to look bad and feel bad. And so avoidance routines develop along with whatever cognitive issues the student may have.
So if you want to motivate a child to read, and if the child doesn't particularly like reading, how can a teacher or a parent help that child want to read?
Well, I would start with the idea that I'd like to put a nice affective umbrella over all the work that I do as a teacher of skills and strategies. And I want to impress upon the child that I believe in them, that I know that they're capable of succeeding. And I would then really try to find out what makes the child happy and what are the interests of the child. And it turns out that there are so many books in the world that if we know the children well, we can probably find reading material that will be of interest to them. And then it's a matter of matching interest and reading level to a particular text. And this is, of course, very challenging. As class sizes get larger, it's much more difficult for the teacher to meet the individual needs of individual students.
And here we have a system of learning support teachers where teachers work with smaller groups of pupils. Are there any particular things that those teachers can do to help children improve their reading? Because they're able to work with a smaller number.
Right. Well, I'm not extremely familiar with the system here, but in general, a classroom that has two or three able teachers is able to spread the resources more effectively, because just the sheer amount of students has been divided. So we're getting into maths here a little bit. And but it still comes down to, can the main teacher and then the helping teacher adequately characterize exactly what it is that the students need, and then in their instructional repertoire, deliver what it is that the student needs. I think a really important goal for any classroom teacher, and that's one working individually or as a team, is to create work for students, have students doing reading and collaborative things, you know, group things, that free the teacher up for the occasional one-on-one work with the student. Now, that should not be busy work, because I think we've all suffered through workbook pages and mindless exercises while a teacher is out working with someone else. But if we are creative and dedicated to the idea that we can create activities that engage students, that help them practice what they've already learned, then we may be able to go off and work with individual students and really address their individual needs.
I also asked Peter Afflerbach, what kind of professional development do teachers need in order to develop their expertise in teaching reading?
Well, if you think about initial teacher training in the United States, I work this semester with a group of 28 undergraduate students who are taking a teaching reading course. They will be taking four courses in reading before they graduate. They will be student teaching. And the state of Maryland, where I work and live, is actually one of the more demanding in that it requires four courses in teaching reading for elementary education majors. For some people, that's it. You know, that's the last professional development support related to what is this thing reading, how do we teach reading. In another scenario, you might have those students coming out working in a school district that hooks up initial rookie teachers with seasoned veterans as mentors and accommodates that relationship by providing time and resources so the mentor can share her or his life experience as a reading teacher with a new teacher who has a lot of questions but not all the answers. Now, in another state, in another district, that might not happen ever. And so where you end up and how you end up being professionally supported and get professional development, again, relates to how forward-thinking is a school district, how much can a school administrator fight for funds and support for such things, what are the priorities of the district and the state, and are funds available for it?
One of the things that often strikes me is that children in school spend a lot of time reading out loud, oral reading, whereas outside of school, with the exception maybe of church, most reading is silent. What do you think about the balance between oral and silent reading in schools?
Well, as you know, silent reading is really the mode of the mature reader, the accomplished, efficient reader. And I think it's really important that students get a lot of practice with their silent reading. Now, the problem is that when we're silent reading, no one can tell how we're doing. And so if the teacher is at all interested in the diagnostic role that listening to a child read plays, then that should be built in. The other place where I think oral reading always should have a part is in storytelling and keeping that the sense of wonder that reading a story aloud can do for us. That, sadly, I think gets taken out of many curricula because it's not seen as of primary importance.
So I think what you're saying is that one of the reasons why teachers do maybe more oral reading is because it's easier to assess their reading?
Well, yes, it's a window into what the student is thinking and doing. You can follow this trace of oral reading and do a thing that's called miscue analysis, which lets you see, is the student paying enough attention to the print? Is the student paying so much attention to the print that they're forgetting that we read to construct meaning? Is the student reading through sentence boundaries? Is the student reading with intonation, with verve? And any of those things can be followed up instructionally if we get a consistent message that something needs attention.
And I know that one of your areas of expertise is on the whole area of assessing reading.
Yeah.
So can you say a little bit more about how teachers can assess pupils' reading competence in different ways?
Yeah, well, there are many opportunities in the school day. You can start by valuing observation and listening. We end up getting a lot of information that's possibly, potentially good about our students just by sitting with them, observing what they do, listening to what they do. But beyond that, the specificity of the assessment's important if we're going to make a good diagnosis and have instruction that's really geared to what we call the teachable moment. And the teachable moment is when a teacher is able to identify what a student needs and then is able to provide it because of a deep understanding of this particular student. One thing that is just, I think, crazy, and I believe that Ireland is not as crazy as the United States in this aspect, is all of the attention that's given to standardized testing. And the testing is, of course, serving an important role, but it is generally so unable to give us valuable information about individual students. It's really used to rank order students in schools and give them percentile grades and raw scores. But if some of our attention were to shift from high-stakes tests, standardized tests, to helping teachers through professional development become assessment experts, what you would see is the increasing ability to address individual students' needs. And to me, that's when you come full circle, your test scores will be higher if your assessment is focused on helping students in a day-to-day basis with what exactly they need.
So if the standardized tests then are of limited help and the information they give is of limited help, what kind of information is useful about a child's reading competence?
Well, there's, you could say that almost anything's going to be a little more sensitive and valuable than a test score. In the United States, if you take a reading test, you typically get the results back a couple of months later. So who knows where you've traveled as a reader from the 4 or 5 months ago that you took the test. And the scores are reported back as a vocabulary and comprehension. Well, if I'm a 79th percentile comprehension person, that tells me absolutely nothing about the nature of my comprehension or how I could improve it. So being a good question asker, I think, is one of the primary tools of a good teacher. You can ask questions as students are reading about their ongoing development of understanding with the text. You can use questions to guide thinking. You can listen to a child reading out loud, as we've said, and do what's called miscue analysis, which gives you a lot of information about sight word development, about decoding strategies, about fluency, or the rate and accuracy of oral reading.
And you've also written something about children self-assessing their reading ability. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, it turns out that anyone out there who is an independent, successful reader is independent in part because they're able to self-assess. And one of the things we know about young children is their need to develop metacognitive awareness as readers. And by that, I mean the ability to monitor oneself from the beginning of a reading task to the end in relation to the goal of reading. And it turns out, from my perspective, a watershed moment for many developing readers is when, after a teacher models this sort of question, does that make sense? Now, if a student's able to ask that question as they finish a sentence, and then as they finish a paragraph, it reminds them, first of all, that we read to construct meaning, and it reminds them that eventually it will be their responsibility to manage the act of reading on their own. Eventually our teachers go away. You know, they go on vacation or they retire. But the successful student reader is one who manages through self-assessment. And we can model self-assessment through such questions. Does that make sense? You can follow that with, is there a problem? Do you know what the problem is? Can you identify it? Can you work to fix the problem? Now, we may have been asked these questions as we developed as readers. However that stuff developed, any good reader is doing that. They may not be aware of it because we often monitor or self-assess at a near automatic level. That's one of the wonders of our brain, that we can keep this monitoring going but not really pay attention to it. When it becomes clear that we're doing the monitoring or self-assessment are those situations when we encounter difficulty. and we slow down, we stop. For example, if we ever find ourselves rereading a sentence, we reread because something has told us we didn't get it. We didn't quite construct the right meaning.
Peter, I just want to move outside the classroom a little bit now and move into the home. And if a parent wants to help their child read better, is there anything you would advise them to do?
Yeah, first of all, watch your anxiety level. As a clinician, someone who's worked in different university clinics and a classroom teacher, one of the things that is very apparent to me is that children who have parents who are anxious about their reading development can develop their own anxiety about reading. And some of those students who are quite able readers will back away from reading because they don't like the anxiety that it induces. I particularly get concerned when I have a parent call me up and say, my child is reading on the sixth grade level, and I would really like it if you could help him. And I ask, well, what grade is your son in? And they say, well, in the fourth grade. And my polite side says, you might not need to be concerned because your son is two grades above reading level. My parent side and are you kidding me side says, why don't you lay off the student a little bit? Your child is above average, and you're probably creating more problems than you're solving by this. Another thing, model reading, model enthusiasm for reading. When a child grows up in a household that has print, whether it's magazines, newspapers, novels, the internet, and when people talk about the things that they read, it's really hard for most children to not fall into that habit of reading for themselves and wanting to talk about things. So valuing reading by modeling it and then discussing it is really important also. Now, I think a lot of parents want to know, what are the skills and strategies that I can teach my child, or how can I follow up from the school day with reinforcement and practice? And that's really something that I would encourage parents to look into, but that takes some pretty high levels of coordination with the classroom teacher. You don't want to be boring your child with stuff they already know, and you don't want to be challenging them with things they haven't yet learned. So coordinating with the teacher is important, but that places another burden on the teacher who's already got a very full instructional day. But to round this out, I'd say, what are your child's interests, and can you get books that your child wants to open up and immerse himself or herself in? And that's a key. I mean, there are so many books out there on so many topics that are of interest to children. It's a matter of finding them. It's a matter of finding them in the bookstore, online, or in the library.
And finally, Peter, if there was one, in the light of all your experience on teaching reading and assessing reading and supporting children learning to read, if there was one thing that you would like teachers in Ireland to remember from your visit here about the teaching of reading, what would that one thing be?
Well, I'd say first that thank you for being teachers of reading. When we step back from what we do and you examine the phenomena of reading, it has to be, if not the most extraordinary human accomplishment, it has to be right up there. And anything that's helpful to an individual student to move towards independent, successful reading is something I would endorse. But I guess I would step back and say, while cognitive skills and strategies get most of the spotlight in the classroom, we cannot forget the affective side of reading, that children read because they have desires, interests, questions about life, and that how they read and how their reading is accepted or not accepted will set the mold for what they do later on in life. And if they feel that they're weak students and they end up moving and turning away from reading as opposed to turning towards it, let's make sure in every classroom that we give students every chance to turn towards reading and experience success.
And that was Professor Peter Afflerbach from the University of Maryland in the United States, who visited Ireland last week as a guest of the Reading Association of Ireland. Once again, I want to thank Brendan Colligan of the Reading Association of Ireland for helping me to arrange the interview. That's all we have time for in this week's Inside Education. If you have comments If you have comments or suggestions for the programme, you can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation, all one word, at dublincityfm.ie. If you miss a programme, podcasts of previous programmes are available on the website, which is www.insideed.com. That is www.insideed.com. Thanks to Barry Hennessy for his news roundup. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening, and stand by for Up and Down, the Urban Music Programme.